Oh, welcome everyone. What perfect timing with the fan, huh? Just miraculously went off. Yeah, welcome. I didn't introduce myself in the beginning, but my name is Carrie Peterson. I know many of you, a local Dharma leader, and Rodney is taking the night off, so I'll be offering a few reflections tonight. And what I'd like to speak about is the subject of faith. And it's a good time of year, I think, for this reflection, just past the darkest day of the year. We're often quite busy this time of year, caught up in a lot of the swirl of things. But even before learning also of Tomoko's passing, I had a close family friend, two young kids pass away last week. And it felt very relevant to speak a bit to faith. It's so natural, I think, when we're close to death in whatever way, that to really take a pause, to really deepen our pause and reflect on what is this? What are we doing? And what's really important? What matters? And to really just take time for that. So I think being close to death can lend itself to a natural reflection on faith. So I also chose this topic because it's not one that I'm naturally drawn to. Rodney, when he first asked me to start giving talks a number of years ago, he said, pick anything you want, just pick something you know really well. And so I picked doubt for a long time. Doubt and fear and the hindrances. So we're so used to investigating and exploring that. And sometimes when we think about exploring faith, it can almost feel a bit of, ugh, I don't quite know what to make of that or how to relate to that concept. So faith, I think, as we generally think about it, can mean or have the association with having a strong belief in something, having a set of beliefs that we're kind of holding fast to that give us comfort. But in this practice, as you know, really the spirit and the heart of it is to investigate, to inquire, to come and see for ourselves. This is the Ehi Pasiko, come and see and inquire. And a lot of us in the West, I think, are much more comfortable with this than we are with faith. With investigation and examination and discovering for ourselves, okay, we can get behind that. But in faith, as it implies belief, we become more uncomfortable. And someone in a class, when I was listening to a teacher talk about faith years ago, who said, that's why I came here in the beginning, because I thought I didn't need faith. Thought that was the whole point, that this is pragmatic. But it's really a central part of the Buddhist teaching. So I want to look at it in a few different ways. And we're all here to some degree or another because we have some belief in this map towards freedom. So whatever our relationship is towards that map, we all have some confidence that it's going in a certain direction that we can rely upon. So it's interesting to reflect on what our relationship is with the maps or the traditional or historical teachings. So as I was thinking about this, I was remembering, I've spent a lot of time traveling in the last few years, often in India and some parts of Southeast Asia where signage isn't exactly abundant and the very difficult sense of direction, and I don't read maps well. So oftentimes I'd be leaving a train station or a bus station or just heading out of a market and with sort of a general sense of where I was going, but not a real clear sense, but kind of with the stubbornness that I would figure it out on my own and get where I was going eventually. And so I would just head off in a direction. And my husband would sort of watch this time after time, how we would leave the train and I would head off in a direction. He would say, Carrie, didn't you want to kind of look at the map or see where we're going? And eventually he just kind of laughed at me, at my kind of blind confidence that I would figure it out on my own, sort of a stubbornness that I didn't need the map. So this is one way that we can relate. And it may get us a certain distance, but it isn't the most efficient way, I think. And then on the other extreme, we can cling so ardently to the map, to the words as we think the Buddha spoke them exactly, and kind of argue about whether or not, you know, our point is exactly right, and so on. We can really get fixed there with clinging to the map as well. So this reminded me of seeing, I think it was in a movie once, where someone had just gotten, this character had just gotten a GPS and was following it in a rental car, and the voice, Siri or whatever the automated voice is, was describing to him where to go. So continue right, whatever it is. But meanwhile, the car was going directly towards a lake. And he's continuing to listen to the voice. So continue right, continue right, continue right. And meanwhile, the car is submerged in the lake, but he's listening to that automated voice telling him where to go. So this is what can happen if we're kind of following the teachings to the letter in a way that's too ardent, too fixed. So a spacious relationship to the maps is somewhere in between those two, heading off on our own stubbornly and following and throwing them away and plunging into the lake. So we can always ask ourselves, where is this leading? I think it's one of the most helpful questions in practice, no matter what intention we're holding or what our action is. Where is this leading? What direction is this going in? So it's not blind and it's not fundamental. And it's not as simple as a belief or a hope that it will all work out okay in the end. So it's much deeper than that. So we know that this belief that, oh, if I just have enough faith or trust, it's all going to work out. Because it doesn't, right? It doesn't. It doesn't. In a training I was in a little while ago, Jack Kornfield was speaking to the teacher trainees about earning a livelihood as a Dharma teacher. And he said, well, you can trust in the money, trust in your heart, trust in what you love, and the money will follow. Or maybe it won't. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. So faith is deeper than that, deeper than a belief. The Pali word for it is actually sada. And it's closer in meaning, in essence, to confidence or trust. It's closer to that than belief. And the origin of it actually refers to the heart. So something that we can rest our heart upon, something that's trustworthy, that we can have confidence in. And it also has a bright quality to it. So a quality of uplift, and it provides energy. So this is important to notice. That when we have faith, we have trust in something, we have energy to take the next step. Our mind is bright. It's when it's skeptical, it's hanging back, it's poking holes in everything, and it's not completely engaged. It's unwilling to take the next step. But when we have this kind of trust or confidence, there's a feeling of inspiration and uplift that is really important. Ajahn Suchito calls faith fundamental openness, kind of the opposite of fixed belief. There's a beautiful image and quote from Thoreau, who spent his life among plants and seeds and out of doors. He says, though I do not believe that a plant will spring up where no seed has been, I have great faith in a seed. Convince me that you have a seed there, and I am prepared to expect wonders. So again and again, faith is compared to a seed in the Buddhist teachings, but also in teachings of other traditions. So many of the Buddhist maps are pointers to things that were not. So kind of defining negative space, almost. So things that hinder us, or looking at, you know, the body, form, feeling, perceptions, consciousness, the aggregates, looking that these things are not to be clung to as I, me, and mine. Looking at the four foundations of mindfulness, all with the intention of moving us in the direction of letting go of what we're not. So this is really important, and this is a crucial step. Even what the maps point to, words that are used for freedom are the unconditioned, or the deathless, the uncreated, the unborn. So everything is defined in almost negative terms, and it gives us very little to hang on to in terms of becoming. And I think that's the point. But there's also, with faith and some of the other qualities of heart, there's an invitation to also be generative in a certain way, to point out all the ways that we usually cling and learn how to let go of our grasping in those areas, but also to cultivate and nurture the potential of the qualities of mind that are naturally present. So faith being one of these. So faith is in a seed is a generative image, a generative map. It's one of the five faculties of mind, which are also called capacities. And when they're developed, they're also considered powers. So they empower us on the journey of awakening. And we need this. It can get very, very difficult. So without some trust and faith and confidence, it's very difficult to continue. So it's worthwhile to reflect on how we relate to this quality. What empowers us to let go? There's a wonderful sutta in which the Buddha comes across a farmer. And he's out on alms round. The Buddha's on alms round. And he comes to a farm. And the farmer is plowing seeds. So he's preparing for the harvest and planting seeds and plowing. He's just finished a day's work along with some of the other people who are working on the farm. And he sees the Buddha with his alms bowl, requesting food in a silent way. And he says to the Buddha, so what are you doing here? You know, here we've been working all day, we've been planting these seeds, and then we eat. This is the order of things, kind of asking or insinuating, you know, what are you doing? Like, what kind of work are you doing? Because usually the order is to work and then eat. And the Buddha responds, well, I too am sowing seeds. I too am harvesting. I'm planting and reaping. And he gives this wonderful analogy. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But again, it's the description of faith being a seed. He says, faith is the seed and practice is the rain. Wisdom is my yoke and plow. Mindfulness is my plowshare and goad. He talks about effort being the animals that carry the plow. He said, and this is how I plow my plowing. The crop it leads is deathlessness. And when one has plowed this plowing, one is released from all suffering. So the farmer says, okay, I get your point. He says, you can eat. You're also a farmer. You're also generating this seed. You're nourishing this seed. And it's valuable and it's worthwhile. This reminds me so much of what people often say when we come back from retreat, or when we've been spending a lot of time in practice. There's often the question of, well, what were you doing all that time? You know, what work were you doing? I had one relative at one point say to me, so, you know, after all these retreats, like what? Like, what do you have to show for it? And so I love this image because when we're kind of in this process, often we don't have a lot to show for it outwardly. But there's faith and trust that we're nourishing some potential that is innate to each of us and that it will bear fruit, that we're part of a natural process that is moving in a direction. And to have continued confidence in that is really empowering and really strengthening. So we can have better responses to people as well when they ask us, well, it doesn't look like anything's happening here. So images like this appear throughout the text, and I find them sometimes much more helpful than the list. So by comparing these different parts of the plow and the ox and the seed and the rain, it gives a really strong image. He's talking about the five faculties of awakening. So he's talking about faith, energy or effort, mindfulness, which is the third, concentration or gatheredness, a unification of mind, and wisdom. And so the beauty of this is that it's never just one quality acting on its own. If it were just faith on its own, then it would be more of the blind faith that we talked about. But it's balanced by wisdom, it's generating energy or effort to make the next step, and the faith and energy are calmed a bit by our gatheredness, by our concentration. And little by little, wisdom is developing. Wisdom to see what's true for ourselves, to discern what's true for ourselves, and what direction we're moving in, what direction is of most benefit. And one of the fundamental pieces here is that we're not doing it. So we're not managing this process, we're not driving this process. It's these qualities that are all interacting together that are moving us forward. We don't have to drive the practice forward. So one more quote with the seed image, which I really enjoy. And this is from the 5th century. So maybe you've heard of the desert fathers, but apparently, I didn't know this, they're also desert mothers. They're women who had headed it out to the desert in the 5th century and left family and society and community because they were drawn to learn from nature, so much like the Thai forest masters and Tibetans up in the Himalayan caves and so on, were drawn to this life of silence and seclusion, this learning from nature. And so this woman, Synkletika, wrote about her experience in solitude and mapped out the whole spiritual journey in terms of a seed. So this is just a little bit of her writing. And it talks a lot about our journey with faith. The seed's true work is but waiting and surrender. Yet to become one who can wait well and yield readily, we practice. The cues from the embryo within us may seem quiet amidst the stir of thunderstorms, the pulse of vitamins and toxins, the beat of sun, and shockingly cold night. But the embryo is still there, without a doubt. Because no seed without those dividing cells, deep at its base, is a seed at all. And so the all already exists, heard or unheard. And this is clear. We are responding, however imperfectly. We have begun. The all already exists, heard or unheard. And this is clear. We are responding, however imperfectly, we have begun. So what do we have trust in? So what do we actually place our faith on? If it's not a belief, what do we have faith in? What holds us? What gives rest to our hearts? And I'm trying to be more linear, so I've come up with 5 things. We'll see how it goes. First of all, we have faith in our own potential more than our imperfections. So this is the potential of the seed. And like she mentioned about the embryo, that's really has the whole blueprint of the path within that seed. The whole tree is contained right within that seed. We too have this potential to awaken. So every time we sit, every time we have a mindful conversation, every time we renew our intention, we're nurturing this potential. And we start to really learn about the dynamics that help it grow. So when we're first starting out, I think we have more faith in either the examples of others, so teachers that we encounter, or nowadays when people start, they have a lot of faith in mindfulness itself, because there's so much research being done as to the effects of mindfulness, everything that it does to the brain, to the physiology, that people can come in with a lot of faith as to what the practice is going to do for them. So I think we start. So faith that comes actually before mindfulness in this sequence of the 5 faculties. So faith is really what allows us to start being mindful in the first place. But generally we see what's more sustaining, I think even in the research, is to see qualities in others that we'd like to emulate. Qualities coming from a teacher or another wise being that we know. So this gives us tremendous motivation to practice. And we commit ourselves to practice in seeing this. But nobody can obviously do this for us, so we have to walk the path on our own. But the teacher's role, as I understand it, is more than inspiring our own motivation, but it also reflects back to us this potential. So I don't know if you've ever had the experience with a teacher, maybe in an interview or in some kind of a conversation, of being in a conversation and feeling as though the teacher was seeing your own potential. Seeing your own potential to awaken. And then seeing you see it. So this is just the lovely mirroring that happens in practice. And then it wakes up even further. So somebody recognizing it in you, you seeing it, and then them acknowledging that you've also seen it. And it's not just our potential, it's the fact that we're already whole. On some deeper level, we're already complete. So it's a gradual path, but in some sense, it's already done. There isn't anything that really, on the fundamental level, needs fixing or changing. So these moments can have tremendous transformative effect. Norman Fisher, was listening to him give a talk once and answer questions, and someone said, "Have you ever met anybody who's enlightened?" And he said, "I haven't met anyone who isn't." And it was such a wonderful twist on, they explain things often a little bit differently in Zen, that it's already complete. On some level, it's already complete. So we can relax. We still make an effort to cultivate and move forward, but on the deepest level, it's done. So one of the Zen patriarchs wrote a series of verses on the faith mind. And one of these, he talked about faith as living without anxiety about imperfection. So faith is to live without anxiety about imperfection. So we're not expecting the world to be flawless. We're not expecting ourselves to be flawless. We don't expect perfection from ourselves. we kind of surrender to our humanness. So feeling this potential actually is a prerequisite to bearing any kind of suffering. Otherwise, it's too much to bear. So when we can start to feel that spark in ourselves, we can actually bear things that are tremendously difficult. So the second aspect of faith is faith that we can meet difficulty without being destroyed, so that we really do have the capacity to bear it. So a story that I think illustrates this better than I can is told by Tara Brach. She talks about this member of her sangha she calls Jacob, who had been a practitioner of more than 20 years, and he was also a psychologist. Some of you have probably heard this. And he was in the middle stages of Alzheimer's disease. So he knew that he was losing his faculties. He was aware that he was losing his capacity. But she recognized in him this tremendous resilience, this kind of lack of despair. And he was saying, on occasion, his mind would go totally blank. He would have no access to words for several minutes and become completely disoriented. He would often forget what he was doing and usually needed assistance with basic tasks. And yet he retained some kind of confidence or faith. So she was asking him about this, and he was recounting one experience in which he was actually offering teachings to a small group of people. Jacob had occasionally given talks about Buddhism to local groups and had accepted an invitation to address a gathering of over 100 meditation students. He arrived at the event feeling alert and eager to share the teachings he loved. Taking his seat in the front of the hall, Jacob looked out at the sea of expectant faces in front of him, and suddenly he didn't know what he was supposed to say or do. He didn't know where he was or why he was there. All he knew was that his heart was pounding furiously and his mind was spinning in confusion. Putting his palms together at his heart, Jacob started naming out loud what was happening. Afraid, embarrassed, confused, feeling like I'm failing, powerless, shaking, sense of dying, sinking, lost. For several more minutes he sat, head slightly bowed, continuing to name his experience. As his body began to relax and his mind grew calmer, he also noted that aloud. At last, Jacob lifted his head, looked slowly around at those gathered, and apologized. Many of the students were in tears. As one put it, "No one has ever offered us teachings like this. Your presence has been the deepest Dharma teaching." Rather than pushing away his experience and deepening his agitation, Jacob had the courage and training simply to name what he was aware of, and most significantly, to bow to his experience. So when he was asked about this, he said that his view was that nothing is really wrong. Whatever's happening is just real life. He didn't make anything wrong. So I think this is a tremendous testament to faith and the power of practice. Because our intellect isn't enough as an object of faith. It's not trustworthy enough. With just a few minutes deprived of oxygen or a few years of plaque accumulating, our intellect goes. It's not reliable. So we can trust in our capacity to bear, our capacity to be aware. So this is trust in awareness rather than our intellect, but also our perceptions and conclusions. So what's it like to be aware of something rather than completely captured by it, rather than completely lost in it? Lost in the content of what we're experiencing. So this is awareness that's not confined to form, that's not completely identified with form. So this is what we become devoted to. This is what becomes more and more trustworthy, is this almost refuge in awareness itself as holding our experience, as holding us within experience. And even though we may be shaking, we may be grieving, we may be experiencing the whole range of emotions, it's not shaking and moving. So this, in a way, is it's like a faith in knowing and not knowing simultaneously. So when we trust awareness, we trust in this quality of knowing. Kind of the paradox is that we can then enter into uncertainty, enter into places that are very unknown for us. So in the text, it's often talked about as faith enables us to cross a desert not knowing what's at the other end, or start off on a long journey. So it really enables us to enter the unknown. To question our own conclusions and limited vantage points. So from here we can explore, we can question, we can investigate. We can see what's true for ourselves. So this is faith in exploration rather than certainty. So one teacher, Winnie Nazarko, says, real faith is to have enough confidence and trust in oneself that the risk of exploration can be tolerated. So we need to be able to tolerate that. This is a poem from Jane Hirschfield called Against Certainty. Many people say that faith and certainty are in direct contradiction to each other. There is something out in the dark that wants to correct us. Each time I think this, it answers that. Answers hard in the heart grammar's strictness. If I then say that, it too is taken away. Between certainty and the real, an ancient enmity. When the cat waits in the path hedge, no cell of her body is not waiting. This is how she is able so completely to disappear. I would like to enter the silence portion as she does. To live amid the great vanishing as a cat must live, one shadow fully at ease inside another. So the mind loves to conclude. It loves its views and it loves to make conclusions and declarations. And we can see as we continue to practice and continue to question that each conclusion, as we explore it, can get pulled out from under us. So it can be disproved. It isn't a reliable viewpoint. Anything that we can fix upon isn't reliable enough. That rug can be pulled out from under us again and again. So to be more and more comfortable with uncertainty and not knowing. So this paradox of knowing and not knowing. So I was thinking about this limitation, how limited our sense of perception and our view can sometimes be. And it was around the time when a lot of the news was coming out about the grand jury's decision not to indict the police officer who took the life of Michael Brown. And I was thinking of it a lot about this process of perception, how this happens to us individually and how it happens to us collectively. How we're not seeing clearly. The mind is not operating clearly. It's making assumptions based on history, based on a collective past, based on associations, and it leads to and generates so much fear and distrust. So in the text, a beautiful description of this is when it's compared to the process of looking across the room, a room that's somewhat dark, and looking at what appears to be a snake from across the room. And so immediately in the body, there's generated this feeling of fear and animosity and maybe wanting to protect oneself or to attack. But the closer we investigate and the closer we explore what actually is there, it turns out to be a rope. It turns out to be benign, innocent. And so this whole flood of instinctual response immediately calms down and it becomes much more simple and we respond very differently. So I was thinking of this as there were these descriptions of all of these misperceptions of unarmed young people, black and brown unarmed young people who were perceived as having weapons. So whether they were in Walmart holding a BB gun or out on the street doing nothing, but this rapid misperception that all of our minds do when they make associations and they get afraid. And I was just appreciating how powerful and what the ramifications can be of this kind of collective misperception that we can have. Ajahn Suchita talks about this as the faith, we must have the faith to not create a world. To not create a whole world for someone else based on such limited information. But this takes a lot of undoing, and it's such a charged area, trying to discern what's real and what's fabricated. So my first response when you know, listening to the news and hearing all about this is to really try to to look at the mind that helps create this problem, but also to really try to make it human, to take it out of the abstract and really give it a human face. So I was trying to look at the stories of some of the people who have been killed recently and really look at their faces, take that in as a human being and read some of their stories just to give it a human face. And in the process of doing this, I came across the website of Ruth King, who's a Dharma teacher who teaches a lot on the East Coast, mostly. A bit on the West Coast. But she had a wonderful website. Let's see if I can find something from it. I have too many quotes. I don't think I can find it. Here it is. So she's talking about offering a talk in Charlotte in the wake of this decision and this news. And so she said that after a 30-minute sit, she held a small ritual in which everyone in the community stated their names out loud. So there was a sense of community and belonging. And then after everyone finished, she just offered a few of the names of the people who had died in the last few months. Just the names, ages, and dates in which they had passed away, being the victims of this violence. And there was a place at which you could click and find out more about them. But she just read a few of these. So I won't read them all, but I just wanted to read just three. Romaine Brisbane, 34, Phoenix, Arizona, December 2nd. Tamir Rice, 12, Cleveland, Ohio, November 22nd. Akai Gurley, 28, Brooklyn, New York, November 20th. It just goes on. list by list, just making that real. And she says, I said to the group that these are just a few of the names of the unarmed men, women, and teenagers killed by police over the past few months. And I am Ruth King, their mother. I found that very powerful. Both the kind of the trusting in the humanness of it, and also asserting her connection to them. And this is, to me, this is like the heart of metta, the heart of loving kindness, the heart of compassion. And it's another version of, it's another example of faith. So it's faith in our deepest intention to come from kindness and compassion. And this is not a passive thing. There's tremendous power in this. So in the Metta Sutta, it talks about loving kindness being like a mother would protect the life of her only child. May all living beings cherish one another. May we cherish all living beings with this same attitude. And if you've ever seen an animal, a mother, any kind of mammal out in the wild protecting her young, this is not a passive force. This is the one of the strongest drives that we have. And the invitation with this intention to be kind is to harness this power, to harness this boundless capacity of heart. Only extend it towards all beings. So not limiting our view to who is our child and who isn't. Limiting our scope of who's worthy of our good wishes and intentions. So it's faith in the power of this intention, and that any action that truly comes out of that will be a powerful action. So the last aspect of faith that I wanted to mention is, and this, I think, deepens the more that we practice. And it goes along with faith in the unknown. But it's really trust in the process of change itself. And this is completely counterintuitive. Because generally, when we're looking for something to rely on, we're looking for something solid. And when we open to the process of change itself, which is just this ongoing flux from moment to moment, it, at the outset, does not seem trustworthy at all. It seems to undermine everything that we think of in terms of security and comfort and safety. But when we're really aligning with this process, it actually offers us a much greater, a deeper, truer safety than any of our small strategies for avoiding it. So we can call this trust in the present moment, but for me, that phrase is actually starting to fall kind of flat. And it seems solid somehow, like this present moment is fixed. I much prefer Gregory Kramer, the teacher of Insight Dialogue. One of his instructions is to trust emergence. So it's trusting the emergent moment, which is in the process of coming forward. So right as I'm speaking, right as you're listening, as sounds are arising, as changing sensations are happening in the body, it's emerging at this moment, and it's never been quite this way before. And then it's fading out. So it's surrendering into that flux of change itself. And again, it's not... It can seem very destabilizing at times. But more and more, I think we begin to trust that flux more than any temporary harbors that we set up. So what happens when we deeply trust is that we can relax. We can let go. So all of the maps that I was talking about in the beginning point towards this letting go. And faith is one of the strengths and powers that enables us to truly let go, to truly surrender. And as we move, as the process continues, what ripens and what comes forward is wisdom and understanding. So faith in something or trust in something becomes more direct knowing. More direct knowing. And understanding that we are a part of the way things are. So this process has its own natural timing. That's why the image of the seed and plowing the seeds works so well, because in all the images of nature, things unfold in their natural time. We don't have to, as one teacher often says, yank up the carrots to see whether they're growing. We don't have to check on our progress all the time and look for proof and evidence that we're developing. We can really sense ourselves as part of a natural evolution, part of a natural unfolding. Still questioning, still always looking, where is this leading? Is this leading to my own benefit and the benefit of others? But we're trusting in this process of change and natural movement. So Thoreau, who I mentioned in the beginning, the faith in the seed, was asked about, at one point when he was near the end of his life, someone asked him about the afterlife. So is there an afterlife? What happens when we die? And he said, I work with one world at a time. I take it one world at a time. But I do know this. He said, I do know that when I die, they will find swamp oak on my heart. So I thought this was interesting for someone who spent his entire life outdoors, sort of devoted to the surveying and the description of the natural world, who's clearly devoted and in love with this. And so this is totally my interpretation, that when he died, this was the nature of his heart. So what he had been committed to, what he had spent his life thinking about and exploring, became him, became who he was, and became the shape of his heart. So I think we can learn from both of these. We can take one world at a time, but we can also trust that wherever we're placing our intention, wherever we're inclining our heart, that it will also become us, will become who we are, become the nature of our character and the expression of our being. So another way of talking about this is, of course, refuge. And so we have faith in the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha, and there's so many ways to understand that. And next week, Rodney will be offering the traditional taking of the precepts ceremony. So you'll have a chance to kind of embody this commitment out loud. Taken in a different way, the refuges have been exactly what I've been talking about. So I'd like to just close with this poem of William Stafford's. It's one of my favorites. It's on the wall in our house, if I can find it. I have so many quotes tonight. It's called The Way It Is. There's a thread you follow, It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you can do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. So let's sit for a minute. Oh, may all beings deepen in faith, in trust, confidence in our own potential, in the process of awakening. May we live with ease and well-being. And may we move in the direction of greater freedom for ourselves and all beings. I really thank you for your kind attention tonight. Rodney always says, don't talk longer than 45 minutes. People can't sustain their attention that long. And you did it. So thank you. Thank you. Anyway, I really appreciate your attentiveness. And what I'd like to do, if you're willing, is to just invite you into a short conversation with a person near you. So this can be short, this can be brief, but more and more I'm convinced and have confidence in our capacity to articulate our experience to each other in a way that's helpful and informative and inspires others. So if you would be willing to do this, I think it could be very productive. So there's no need to do anything formal or to rearrange your chairs in a formal way, but just find someone next to you, introduce yourselves, and just for a few moments for each of you to share what is something that you find trustworthy. So in the way that I've been speaking about it, in terms of confidence, what we rest our heart upon. So I mentioned all sorts of possibilities. If one of these resonated, please feel free to say what arose for you. So trust or confidence maybe in our own potential, in the process of change itself, maybe a refuge in awareness, and in this path of transformation. So really, whatever feels genuine and authentic, just speak it as a gift to your partner. And if nothing is there for you, of course, that's fine too. Just do this for a couple of minutes, and I'll ring the bell in a few minutes. So anything that you'd like to share from your conversation or reflections or questions from the talk?
But that quote was just really powerful in that respect. You have to relax, you have to have faith.
Yeah. To be without anxiety about imperfection. So there's a lot of wisdom in that also, too, right? In seeing that this is the way that it is in this realm, in this human realm. That we never really get it right, you know, that it doesn't ever work for very long, and that's kind of a futile attempt. So, so we can relax into that a bit, be without anxiety for imperfection. Yeah. And then we can enjoy it a little bit more too.
Just to follow on that, we also talked about anxiety. It too is incredible.
Right.
And the emergence of faith and faith.
Yeah. Right.
And also this idea of talking about this.
Say the last part again. And Okay. I realized I should have been repeating the questions. I'm sorry. But I realized I should have been repeating the questions because not everyone can hear, so I apologize for that. But he was appreciating the impermanence of anxiety as well. Right. Yeah. And I was thinking about that actually with despair. I didn't mention it in the talk, but sometimes faith and despair are talked about together. And with despair, there's really a quality of of giving up. But there's not a recognition of time in that either, of change of time. It's, this isn't worth it, and it's never going to be worth it. Or it's always going to be like this. Right? And so with a lot of those emotions, we've taken ourselves out of the river of change, so they can't move as freely. We've lost touch with that. So, yeah, thank you for that. And he was also appreciating the chance to talk about it a little bit. I think this is so valuable, even though we might resist it because it's not what we're used to. Sometimes a bit of inner grumbling, myself included. It's often surprising what comes out of our own mouths and hearing our experience reflected in others, like the mirroring I was talking about, is really important. So, thanks. So she was appreciating the different perspectives on faith that I mentioned that felt more constructive, because sometimes she has a difficulty with just faith and awareness, or what was the other?
Formless.
Faith in the formless. So it can be kind of hard to access, and how do I access something that's that large? What came to mind as you were speaking was Stephen Batchelor's book that's called The Faith to Doubt. Yeah, it's, and I have only read parts of it, but the title has been encouraging to me. faith that we can actually question, you know, that process of questioning is in itself transformative. So sometimes when we say we're trying to have faith in awareness, it can feel like trying to have faith in God, in something that's out there that I can't quite feel, that I don't really have a relationship with, that doesn't, it's not my direct experience. So it's not something that I can relax into. But we start by noticing what happens when we're aware of our experience, like you know, when we're aware of doubt, what happens? When we're aware of that process of toggling back and forth, is this right, is this not right, I can't quite figure this out, well, she said this and he said that, and should I really be here, and well, do they have it or not, and it's this, so what is it that can know that whole stream, that whole ping pong match, you know? I don't think of it as some otherworldly thing that delivers us from that, but just that knowing of that isn't caught by it. So that's the process of deepening confidence, that that we can be more in the knowing of the struggle than caught in the tangle itself. And that, I think, grows over time, yeah. Anybody else before we close? Interesting with the lighting, huh? What's coming next? This was not planned. Yeah. Okay. Well, if there aren't any other comments, then I'll just make a few announcements and we'll call it a night.